I'm Joe Bianca.
I'm Bill Finley.
I'm Jonathan Green.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:15, Wednesday, January 13th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And thank you to the dumbest, saddest people in America for immediately proving my prediction wrong that 2021 would be okay.
Yeah, how's your 2021 going? Wow, big improvement over 2020. How about that? Hi, I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News.
Jonathan Green, general manager from DJ Stable. And I'm looking forward to interviewing the guy who bought a horse for $650,000 and named it Fenway.
That's Bill's beat.
Exactly. Exactly. We'll see if Bill picks up. Bill, you can even ask Jack that question if you want.
I didn't even know. How about that?
Play stump the writer. All right, good.
Both can commiserate over Mookie Betts still. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. The Keeneland January Horses of All Ages sale is going on right now. It started Monday. The third session will kick off in a little bit here, and then the closer is tomorrow, Thursday, January 14th. Visit january.keeneland.com for more details on the sale, which we saw yesterday features the dispersal of Samsung Farm and Paul Pompa Jr. All right, so we had some sad news in the racing world yesterday that Prince Khalid Abdullah, who is the owner, founder of Judmont Farms, passed away. He was 84 years old. If you want to read all about his life and his story and his horses, I highly suggest you go on the TDN website and read Kelsey Riley's obituary. She did a really great job with it. Obviously, they've had tons of great horses over the years, tons of Group One winners overseas, and then a bunch of Breeders' Cup success. And I think for me, at least the three horses that that he'll be remembered for, and that Judmont will be remembered for in my lifetime, at least so far, are Frankel, who was an absolute superstar on the racetrack and has become a really good sire as well. Arrogate, who was, for my money, the best American dirt horse that Judmont has ever had. They bought him with the idea of getting to the Derby. They bought a couple of dirt horses in the mid-2000s trying to do that. They didn't actually get him to the Derby, but he obviously proved himself to be an all-time great. And then, of course, Enable, who was just retired recently. And I think Enable kind of summed up the sportsmanship of Khalid Abdullah and Judmont pretty well in her coming back to the races over and over again. And I thought that was, we talked about it at the time, but I thought that was great for racing. That was great for racing fans that, you know, they kept bringing her back as long as she was able to run at a top level. And she ran through her 6-year-old year. You don't see a lot of top horses run 4 years anymore. So that was, I think that kind of summed up how dedicated they were to the sport and to showcasing the sport's superstars. But the thing that I'll always remember about Khalid Abdullah and Judmont is that, you know, when I first started watching racing in the mid-2000s, those were the iconic silks, the kind of iconic silks that immediately conferred respect on whoever that horse was. And there aren't that many silks like that. I guess you could say, you know, Godolphin and Coolmore, but there aren't that many that you look and you see the jockey silks and you think immediately, that must be a serious horse. I should take a look at that horse. And I think that's a credit to all the work that they did to build up that operation. And it's still going strong. But I just wanted to get some of your guys' initial thoughts on his passing and what he's built Judmont into.
Joe, one of the numbers that stood out to me when I read Kelsey's story, 118 grade one class group one winners. I mean, that's just unfathomable for an owner to have won that many. I don't know where that stacks up against Godolphin and Coolmore, which would be the other two that might be in that sort of category, but that's an incredible number. And I guess the one question as we go forward from this is what is now going to happen to Judmont? You know, we know nothing about his heirs or relatives, children, et cetera, who might want to keep the Judmont brand going and continue to operate at a high level. Let's hope that that's the case, because it would be a real shame for horse racing to see Judmont go away. So we'll obviously find that out over the next year or so. But let's all hope that there is going to be more Judmont Farms in the future.
Yeah. And Joe, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, he was a man who just, you know, built a program and a dynasty, you know, around the world. And when you saw the green and pink and white, and actually it's an homage, that's why I'm actually wearing green and white today. You always immediately at least looked up the horse to see whether or not, you know, what his past performances were and what his pedigree is. And, you know, most of the time you were impressed with the lineage as well as the racing ability. I don't think in all the years I've been in racing, I don't think I ever saw a Judmon horse in a claiming race. The thousands and thousands of horses that they've had, I never saw one with a price tag next to his name. They just didn't do it. And it wasn't because they didn't have, they had horses that weren't able to compete at that top level. Obviously they did. But in any program, you're going to have horses that aren't going to, meet that high bar, but I never saw one in a claiming race. They would put them in sales occasionally, or they would retire them. But you would never see one, running, at Monmouth Park or Mountaineer or Presque Isle for beaten 10, or something like that. And just that always impressed me that they had such an ancillary program, that you never heard about horses that weren't able to keep up the brand, and keep up the level. The other thing, I've never met the man. And in reading, the story that Kelsey wrote and other stories on him, the one thing that resonated with me was he was a man who let his horses do the talking. And in our industry, which is full of such egomaniacs, me included, that love to hear themselves talk and love to immediately, before they even grab the trophy of a race, they're grabbing somebody's microphone to talk about how wonderful the horse is and how, more importantly, wonderful they are. There was a man who rarely gave interviews and rarely talked about anything other than, the accomplishment of the horse and the accomplishment of the trainer and the people involved in the horse. And that always, resonated with me as well in an industry full of blowhards. You didn't see that from, from that camp. And it started right with Prince Abdullah, that he was a man of class. And again, I never met him. But from everything I've read, it just seemed like that he was, just top shelf with everything that he did.
Yeah. And that's a really good point, John, that, he really was never front and center. It's to the point where I didn't even really know what he looked like until the news came out. And, he was always played the background and let guys like Garrett O'Rourke, be forward facing to the media, and condolences to Garrett O'Rourke and everybody at Judmon as well. But yeah, that was kind of noble in a business, like you said, that's dominated by egomaniacs who just have to have the spotlight when they have great horses. And God knows he had enough great horses that he could have had the spotlight if he wanted to. But he was content to play the background and let the horses do the talking, like you said. Some of those horses, the first real successful horse that they had was Known Fact, who became a champion and a multiple Group One winner. And then he was the first real successful stallion that Judmon had as well in the mid-80s. He had Mark of Distinction and Warning, who were Group One winners for Prince Khalid. And then the fillies, I think, really became his legacy in the 1990s. You had horses like Logician, Bated Breath, obviously was a cult, but you had Close Hatches, Heat Haze, Banks Hill, another great filly, Champs Elysee, Cacique, Cityscape. Like, there were, and then eventually came Dan Silly and Dane Hill, and that kind of really established the stallion tree that Judmon was kind of famous for. And Frankel was, I think, the culmination of that, who was just, an absolute star on the racetrack. And I think that was, he was just one of those horses that was appointment viewing, same with Enable, same with Arrogate. And it just seems like they did things the right way. And they just always had, they always have top class horses who were managed well. And I think that's their legacy as well. And it'll be interesting, like you said, to see what happens with Judmon going forward without the patriarch of the program. But I think he's left in place a good infrastructure to keep the thing going. And we're going to talk about the LeCompte Stakes a little bit later. They have a horse this Saturday, Mandaloon, in the LeCompte as they try to get that Derby win. He's 2-for-2 TDN Rising Star. So we'll see if he can carry on the legacy, at least in the short term. But, like I said, I think those three horses, Frankel, Arrogate, and Enable, all in different ways, really represented the legacy of excellence that Judd Mott represents and that Khaled Abdullah represented in racing. So obviously a big deal, big passing in racing, and like I said, great job by Kelsey Riley doing the obituary. So condolences to everybody at Judd Mott and everybody that knew him. He was a landmark, you know, kind of guy in racing that he really stood for a great program and built a great program. All right, so we mentioned it in the open and in the ad read that Keeneland January is going on right now. It's a 4-day sale. Horses of all racing age. On Monday, there was a short yearling by Munnings who topped the session at $475,000, which is pretty good price for Keeneland January for a short yearling, bought by Larry Best, who continues to expand his footprint in the game. He's kind of been buying at every sale. I feel like he's in the news. But yesterday started the dispersal section of the sale, and that was, I think, we all knew where the real fireworks were going to come. And the two main dispersals were the estate of Paul Pompa Jr., who unexpectedly died a few months ago, and then Samson Farm, which is obviously one of the great Canadian breeding operations in history. Regal Glory, who's a graded stakes winner, also a TDN Rising Star, topped the session yesterday at $925,000. Peter Brandt bought her. Dance for the Cause, who was a Samson horse, was bought by Gainsway for $925,000. We had Deceptive Vision, another Samson horse, was bought by Hillendale for $900,000. Samson sold Southern Ring to Phil Schoenthal for $875,000. And then Beautiful Lover, who was another Paul Pompa color bearer, sold for $650,000 yesterday to Moyglare Stud. So top five horses at yesterday's sale were all from those dispersals. And obviously that juices up a sale. I'm wondering if John had any impressions from the bidding so far.
Yeah, Joe, you hit the nail on the head as far as the important part of the sale so far. And that is anything that was under a dispersal banner was overvalued. I mean, the horses that you're talking about that were selling, you know, we had valuations. We spoke to other people in the field that had valuations, and they were literally 40, 50% of what the actual hammer price was. So, I remember when Calumet had a dispersal and people were literally not only buying the horses, but they were going afterwards to the barns and trying to buy the feed tubs because they wanted to have a piece of history. And not that these two, you know, not that the Pompa program is necessarily in that level. Samson certainly is. And you know, even more so in North America and Canada than here in the States. But you know, they were a staple. They were certainly history in the making, in the horse industry, and they had horses that were, you know, that bound the fabric of modern racing. So people were overspending to have a piece of those horses. And I think that there is a spillover effect going on with some of the other horses that aren't under the dispersal sales that also were maybe a little bit overvalued as well. But you wouldn't know that anything was going on in the world if you looked at the Keeneland sale and the way the results are going. It seems like it's business as usual, especially for the upper end. The only new thing that I heard in watching the sale and also being involved in buying and selling over the past couple of days is that, you know, normally they announced, hey, this horse coming to the ring is, you know, a half to this and a son of this or a daughter of that. And this horse, you know, was you know, breezed in 10 flat as a 2-year-old. They actually started to announce, Joe and Bill, that this horse coming in the ring was a TDN Rising Star. So value added by the TDN for making these horses, and lifting them up when they're young. And obviously, if they're on the TDN Rising Star, that is a selling point for people down the road. So just remember to keep those Rising Stars, keep it near and dear to your heart, because they definitely add some value down the road.
Yeah, I mean, people should treat it like it's valuable with the way they harass us sometimes about making Rising Stars. But yeah, it's understandable. I've seen it on commercials too. I think there was a DeMarchelier commercial by Claiborne talking about how he was a Rising Star. So yeah, that's kind of a big deal. We had a couple this past weekend that we might get to. We're going to talk to Jack Wolf later of Starlight, who owns a Rising Star that I made on Sunday. But yeah, just to the point about dispersals, I think Samson is... dispersal in particular is a really unique opportunity to get into these great families. I mean, Paul Pompa obviously owned some really nice horses, but he was more of a recent addition to racing, and his horses were kind of just that first generation that he was in charge of. But Samson's been doing this for decades and has champions up and down the pedigrees of some of these horses. So that's obviously a unique opportunity to buy into those. It's like the Canadian, almost like the Canadian Phipps family. The Phipps family had, you know, a dispersal. They'd be lining up around the corner to buy into those families. So that's a unique opportunity. And I think that has really helped boost the bottom line for Keeneland so far. So we wish them luck for the last 2 days of the sale. And then I think the sales front goes a little dry until OBS March, and you know, hopefully we can run all the sales on time this year. But yeah, this kind of wraps up the breeding stock season, and then we'll turn our attention to 2 year olds in a couple months. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward, and this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
All right, this week on the Racists in Horse Racing beat, we had a big story about Eric Guillot, who's a Cajun trainer who had a couple of big horses. He had Lauban, might have had a couple other older horses that were good. He was the one that accused Luis Saez of using a buzzer to win the Traverse with Will Take Charge. So he's a very, very outspoken jerk, as I call Carl Broberg, but I think he's a little worse than that, and that's why a lot of people like him, a lot of people hate him. He has this big bombastic personality, but he got in some hot water because of a horse that he named Grape Soda. Now, before anybody says anything about like millennials or PC culture or any of that nonsense, the phrase itself, Grape Soda, isn't inherently racist. What's racist about it is he named the horse after Ken Rudolph, who's a talking head over at TVG, one of the few black people on TV in racing, period. And he named the horse that in honor of Ken Rudolph, because it's a stereotype that black people drink grape soda. And he doubled down with, like, you got to go look at it if you haven't seen it. You probably have seen it, but he doubled down with a tweet about the horse's workout and said it was like smooth, like a cool menthol or something, and then put like the black power fist emoji. And then he had another horse that he was going to name Uncle Ken's Cabin. So it's like, you know, it's pretty hard to deny the racism behind this, even if you don't understand the connotation that grape soda has. This was clearly him being racist towards one of the few, you know, visible black people in horse racing. And that's the kind of thing that we're trying to get rid of. And, you know, I had that rant back when Barkley Tagg said that thing. And, you know, why do we not have more people of color in racing? It's because of people like Barkley Tagg. It's because of people like Tom Van Meter. It's because of people like Eric Guillot. And, you know, a lot of people have rightfully spoken out about this and said, you know, this is what exists in racing, and we don't really confront it. We don't really talk about it, that, you know, this is a big mystery about how we get more diversity in racing. Like, flush these people out of the industry, and then you might do a little bit better. So, you know, it's not worth getting super worked up over. Sue wanted me to do a big rant because, you know, to start the 2021 rant reel early on, but it's just, he's such an idiot, and he's irrelevant. You know what I mean? He's corny and irrelevant that it's not worth getting worked up over. But, you know, there was a swift response from the industry, NYRA and the Jockey Club, and, you know, they pretty much banned him, which I don't think is a big deal anyway. He hasn't run any horses of relevance for years, but it was good to see that industry response over something that is, you know, should be unacceptable in any sport.
Yeah, I mean, Joe, you wonder what this guy was thinking. I mean, first of all, even if you feel that way, why would you do something? You know, why would you get yourself into such hot water? And, you know, this, he's been banned now by NYRA, he's banned by the Stronach Group Tracks, which is, you know, a little bit odd to ban a guy who said he's retired. That was the other part of the story. And I think this was some sort of parting shot that, you know, he wanted this to run. He wanted all this attention. Matter of fact, that he put a first-time starter by Uncle Mo, who is the sire of Grape Soda, in a maiden claiming race, and the horse did get claimed. I wonder if, you know, he wanted the horse to win so badly so that he would get all this attention. So, you know, right now, he's even had some things on Twitter afterwards, like he had a picture of a Grape Soda bottle and like the stand at a convenience store and stuff like that. So, I mean, he apparently thinks this is all funny. It's not all funny. And the other thing I wonder, I mean, I don't know how old he is, but he's not 80 years old or something. You know, what is he going to do with the rest of his life? Why would he retire now? And, you know, a lot of the people that do these sort of things, they do come back into racing, or they get a job as a bloodstock agent, maybe a jockey agent, something like that. So, you know, maybe this ban will come back to bite him. But I'm with you. You know, it really didn't matter to begin with. You got your 15 minutes of infamy. Go away.
Yeah, and I'm going to – you guys covered that side of the ledger pretty well. I'm going to look at the other side of the ledger, which is when this came out and when it was, you know, brought to everyone's attention of, you know, all the racist tweets and the innuendos about the horse's name, you know, NYTHA and Rob Masiello, who's one of the board members of NYTHA, I'll give him, you know, the most credit out of all, you know, everyone involved. Joe Applebaum went immediately to NYRA and David O'Rourke, and they got together and went immediately to the Jockey Club. And literally within hours after this was all brought to light, you know, the horse's name was needed to be changed. And credit the new owner, because the horse was claimed. The horse was claimed in the race after winning. And the new owner came out and said, not only am I going to change the horse's name, but I'm going to donate a percentage of the horse's earnings to Backstretch Appreciation and Backstretch Charities going forward. So at least there's some positive news out of this situation where there is, you know, there were people involved on all ends, you know, of the spectrum that came in and said, we're not going to stand for this. We're not going to accept this in racing. And not only that, we're going to put an immediate change to this name. And the benefits are going to be that people on the backstretch are going to be able to get money from this horse's future purse earnings. So that way the horse goes from, and the horse had nothing to do with this, but the horse goes from being a negative symbol to being a positive symbol and one that people want to root for, because the more that horse wins, the more the backstretch benefits from it. And if there's a silver lining out of this whole situation, it's that there are good people in racing, and the good people far outnumber the bad people. And like Bill said, this jerk's 15 minutes of fame is about 16 minutes old by now. And what's going to happen now, hopefully, is that there's going to be a bigger benefit to the industry because of what that jack did.
Yeah, and I got to say that I was honestly shocked at how quickly the industry reacted to this. I was off on the day, but I was perusing the TDN websites, and it was the number one story. And I was like, what could he possibly have done to merit this kind of response? But obviously, it was pretty terrible what he was saying and what he was doing. That I don't know. I think that, you know, this is another example of the industry now finally, after all these years, trying to get ahead of these things, as opposed to always. We talked about this, you know, when we were first doing the podcast, about what a problem it is that racing is usually reactive instead of proactive. And this is, I think, another case where they're trying to get ahead of this and not let it simmer and fester and make racing look bad. So yeah, I was actually pretty surprised at how quickly they acted on it. And you know, no one will miss him. He's thoroughly embarrassed himself, and now he can screw off into obscurity.
Joe, I have one more thing I want to add about this. I was a little bit curious about, you know, names of horses in the past, and I decided not to write a story about this because it would have been insensitive and would have been kind of an ugly subject. But if you want to think about racing, where it was, where it's been, where it is today, I would suggest somebody go to Equibase and enter in names that are racial slurs for blacks. Obvious things, much more obvious than Grape Soda. And I'm not even going to repeat them here, but you know the type I mean. You would be shocked at how many of these names in the 60s, 70s, and even 80s of these horses just went out. And I don't think anybody ever said a word about that. So, you know, is racing more racist than general society? I'm not really sure. But, you know, if you want to talk about where it was and, you know, the insensitivity of some people in racing, it was really shocking.
Owning multiple graded stakes winning racehorses like Hard Not to Love and Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. There is West Point news this week. Jason Blewett is going to be leaving Gulfstream Park. He's done a great job down at doing the television stuff at Gulfstream. He's going to be joining West Point as a partner account representative. And he's a good guy. I've spoken to Jason before. I did a story with him. Used to work at Naira, obviously, and then moved down to Gulfstream. He's done a really good job. So best of luck to Jason and West Point. I think that's a great pairing. And also West Point has some news on the racetrack. We're going to talk a little bit about the LeCompte Stakes. They're going to have Arabian Prince, trainee of Dallas Stewart, in the Grade 3 LeCompte this Saturday at Fairgrounds, starting the road to the 2021 Derby. So best of luck to everybody at West Point. All right, so we had the Sham on the first Saturday of 2021. So I guess you could say that technically started the 2021 Derby Trail, but I feel like it starts this Saturday with the LeCompte at Fairgrounds. It's a mile and a 16th, $200,000 for three-year-olds. Starts the triad of Fairgrounds preps with the LeCompte, the Risen Star, then culminating in the Louisiana Derby. It's got an interesting looking field, probably get a pretty big field as these early Fairgrounds preps usually do. They usually get 13, 14 horses. The two big horses I would say are Mandaloon, who we mentioned earlier, Judd Mott, Homebred, who's 2-for-2 and is a TDN Rising Star, trained by Brad Cox, and then Proxy, who's a Godolphin homebred by Tappet, was trained by Mike Stidham. He's part of the latest vanguard of Godolphin horses that they're pointing towards the Derby to finally get that one big Derby win. So I feel like this is the real start of the 2021 Derby Trail this Saturday, and we're gonna have 3.5 months, and then we're gonna do the fantasy contest again. And I'm interested if you guys have any thoughts about how we want to do that this year. We'll just go really quick through some of the other preps that are coming up after the LeCompte. We have the Smarty Jones on January 22nd at Oak Lawn. January 30th, we have the Bob Lewis and the Holy Bull, a couple grade threes at Santa Anita and Gulfstream, respectively. The Withers and the Sam Davis are the following weekend. So it's really going to ramp up pretty quickly here in terms of Derby preps. There's going to be a lot of opportunities for a lot of different horses. But that's just what's coming up in the next couple of weeks. Thinking we would start it around the Fountain of Youth, which is the second of the three Gulfstream preps before the Florida Derby and after the Holy Bull. That to me is like the real big kind of turning point race on the calendar, where if your horse isn't back from its break in the winter by the Fountain of Youth or thereabouts, you're probably not making the Derby. Like, I know that Justify, you know, defied all logic and all conventional wisdom about what it takes to get to the Derby a couple of years ago. But just in general, if you're not racing by March, I think that you're probably not going to be in the Derby. So that seems like a good place for us to start. But I'm wondering what you guys think.
I'm happy with that, Joe. I mean, you know, for the fantasy contest, a race like the LeCompte, it's just too early to get involved in something like that. The Mandolin is very interesting, and not so much the horse itself, but I mean, what kind of story is Brad Cox going to be this year and years going forward? I mean, is he going to become the biggest threat to Bob Baffert when it comes to dominating these kind of races? And he very well could. So I'm on board. Why don't we do it before the Fountain of Youth? Because we can get the points from the Fountain of Youth. And then it's, there's not a ton of guesswork. I mean, right now, you know, how could you do it? Just guessing about everything. I mean, for all we know, the Kentucky Derby winner is a horse none of us ever even heard of at this point. So I'm on board. Let's get him this year.
Yeah, the only other thing I would throw out there, guys, is that in accordance with the points, you know, for the Kentucky Derby, the very first 50-point prep is the Risen Star, which is February 13th. So, you know, in past history, even last year, which was a goofy year, you need to have at least like 27 points, 25 to 27 points to qualify to get in as one of the top 20 horses, which is usually a second place in one of these 50 point races, and then placing in another race. So I could also make the fair argument that maybe we should look at the Risen Star on February 13th as the opening weekend. But it's not a big enough deal if you guys are married to, hey, the Fountain of Youth, because that is such a signature race. And that also, you know, that's the second 50 pointer. And then from that going forward are all really what I would consider would be the major preps of, you know, of the Derby trail.
Yeah, I think that week before the Fountain of Youth, like when we have probables for the race, I think is probably the way to go. I think the Risen Star, things are still going to be a little bit murky. But just also a really good point by Phil about Brad Cox, because, you know, it's no guarantee that these big trainers are going to win derbies. It took Todd Pletcher really, really long time to win a derby. Chad Brown still hasn't even come close to winning one. So I think that'll be an interesting storyline to watch. You know, Brad Cox is obviously the now trainer in racing, but that's no guarantee when it comes to derby success. So I think that'll be one of the subplots along the Derby Trail. But that sounds good. So I think the week of the Fountain of Youth, we'll have a good sense of who's back, who's on the Derby Trail, and we'll run that derby contest back, because that was fun last year.
Okay. And are we doing it in reverse standing order? Does Bill get the pick, I get the second pick, you get the third pick? Or?
Yeah, that's totally fine. Bill tanked. Bill successfully tanked on the New York Jets.
Thanks for Trevor.
I tanked for essential quality.
Yeah. unlike the Jets, he successfully tanked, so he should be rewarded for it. Yeah, I mean, I picked Tiz the Law first, number one last year, worked out for me pretty well. So, yeah, I think that sounds like the right way to go.
Okay. And I think I don't know if Brian's going to be in the contest or not, but I owe him a fifth round draft pick for this year. So,
player to be named later.
Player to be named later. Exactly.
That's it. All right. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtv.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more at greenco.com. So our Green Group Guest of the Week this week is the owner of Starlight Racing, who has basically the most exciting horse in America right now, Jack Wolf. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Great to talk to you. So obviously exciting times right now for Starlight. We'll start with the big horse, with Charlatan. He obviously was going to be, if not the favorite, among the favorites in the Kentucky Derby. Had to go on the shelf for a while, came back with the dazzling performance in the Malibu. Can you just take us through the kind of emotional roller coaster of feeling like you had the Derby favorite, having that disappointment, and then having him come back after the break with such a big race?
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. It was a roller coaster. You know, initially we had three big horses in there, of which Charlatan looked like he was probably going to be the best of the three, with Eight Rings and Authentic. And then all this stuff happened, and we went to Arkansas and, you know, got the DQ there. And so just put everything up in the air. We had to, you know, remove, I think, a small chip of some sort. But in any case, when you got somebody like Bob Baffert adjusting to all these changes, I think we have a little bit of an advantage over everybody else in that he had, I guess, 7 weeks between the Monmouth race and the Derby, and he had the horse, you know, just perfect. So I don't think Authentic would have won the Derby if it was run May 2nd. He's May full, needed some maturity, and it all just worked out. Crazy business.
Hey, Jack, it's Bill Finley, and thanks for joining us. And back to Charlatan. It looks at this point, Bob Baffert has said, you're going to pass the Pegasus, going to go to Saudi Arabia. So could you just talk about the decision to go there, pass on the Gulfstream race? And also looking forward, I mean, I know it's probably premature to even talk about this, but what are some of the major goals so far as races this year, other than the obvious, the Breeders' Cup Classic?
Yeah. You know, Bob's so good at placing these horses Tom Ryan and myself, we started this thing some time ago, and Tom wanted to send all the colts to Bob, which in hindsight's a very good call. And as far as the racing decisions, we leave that up to Bob. And talking to Bob, I think it's in public knowledge, his reasoning behind going to Saudi instead of the other race, the purse money. I think Bob loves the surface over there in Saudi, one turn, mile and an eighth, coming back too soon on 4 weeks with the previous race. And I think it just all made sense. And as far as, going forward, try to answer, but, just take them one at a time. See how he comes back.
And Jack, it looks like you have another exciting young colt in Spielberg, who who won the Grade Two Los Alamitos Futurity. Give us, walk us back to when you signed the ticket for $1 million to buy him, all the way up to winning this race. What are your feelings when you pony up and buy a horse for $1 million, and then when subsequently he wins a big race like that, and looks like he's going to be one of the contenders for the Derby?
I thought he was too until I read the TDN's choices yesterday.
We had nothing to do with that.
And, he does have 12 points already. So, the game plan is to try to average, around 450, 500 for the horses. And if you're going to do that, you're going to have to pay, occasionally $1 million for a horse. And sometimes we buy them for 150, 250, 350, something like that. But it was a horse that our bloodstock team, which is Donato Wani and Frankie Brothers, that obviously really liked, bought the horse. And as we all know, it's hard to get these horses, whether they're expensive or cheap, to win these stake races. But he's doing fine. And I don't know what the next step is for him, but for that matter, I guess there's a million and a half dollar race over in Saudi too that we might take a look at.
Interesting. All right, so there was another really promising young horse that you guys had over the weekend named Jouster. She's a daughter of Noble Mission, cost $360,000 facing August Saratoga. Obviously a lot to spend on a Noble Mission. She took a bunch of money in her first two starts, ran okay, and then really, really flourished on the turf the other day, won by 8 3/4 lengths. I made her a TDN Rising Star. Can you talk about her and your thoughts about her going forward?
Yeah, obviously I think we've got her on the right surface now. The first race, as you said, up at Saratoga, she ran okay in the slop. The horse that beat her hadn't come back and done much, but I think we've got her on the right surface. The field that she beat the other day by eight and a half lengths were some pretty nice horses. And I was talking to one of our partners last night, and he asked if I thought that we'd win the race. I said, well, I was at the race, so I'm not going to go down there without thinking we're going to win the thing. But in any case, I didn't think we'd win by 8 1/2 lengths. And so she'll probably run an allowance race next and, point for, something like the Belmont Oaks or, some of those longer turf races in the summer.
Hey, Jack, switching gears a little bit, I want to talk about your role in the industry so far as Thoroughbred Aftercare. And you're one of the founders of the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance. Starlight has always been really ahead of the curve when it comes to this important issue. So two-part question. How far has horse racing come, say, in the last 20 years when it comes to taking care of the athletes when they retire, and what still needs to be done?
Bill, I think when we started this thing, it was a perfect timing, and we could get everybody's ear. And thank goodness, Keeneland and the Jockey Club and Breeders' Cup, funded the thing initially. But, that was when the eight bells thing had happened, and it just all fell in place, and a lot of the right people in the industry got behind it. And I think since then, they've done very well as far as, you know, keeping the thing going. The problem is it seems like we're sort of stuck at like $3.5 million, which I guess you can say that's not a bad spot, but I think we need to find ways to increase that to, you know, 10, 12, 13 million, something like that. And it seems to me, I mean, you guys would have a better pulse than me, but it seems like it's a subject that the, you know, is more aware than what it was, what, 7 years ago.
Yeah, no question about it. People are certainly becoming more aware of aftercare and retirement, but it's because of programs like you know, like TAA and what you've been putting together that gives people a platform. So we all very appreciate it and appreciate the leadership you have on that front. And then Jack, you're also, you know, very involved in other initiatives that we've talked about before. We've interviewed Pat Cummings, you know, on the show, and he has some interesting ideas with his organization that you're involved with. So tell us a little bit about the genesis behind that group.
Well, Craig Bernick and I met each other through the TAA, and he and his family contributed a good amount to, you know, help get the thing going. And so just sort of fast forward, once you know, we resigned from the board, I think Craig was looking for, you know, something to spend his time and effort on as far as helping the industry, and came up with this sort of a think tank that he's got going right now. I think we got a great board, some great ideas, but, you know, as I said from the get-go, you know, we've got to get some of this stuff implemented. And if it's just going to be a think tank, you know, that's not going to get it. So that's how I got involved. Hopefully some of the matters that Pat brings up, hopefully we can execute.
Well, I mean, that's a good point. I wanted to follow up on that. How do you think, what is the sticking point? How do you think that more of those ideas come into fruition in racing? What do you think is holding up the powers that be in racing from taking on some of these initiatives?
It's, as we all know, this industry is so hard to get change. And to, you know, I was looking at y'all's interview with Jim Gagliano the other day. I mean, look how long it took them to get the legislation and all that. So it's just, I think, a function of getting the right people to, you know, get behind some of these things and not only, you know, in the case of the Thoroughbred Idea thing, but also in the aftercare thing. I mean, the Breeders' Cup, Keeneland, the original people that were in the TAA, if we could, you know, get them together and just make mandatory funding of these things, I think that's the way to go.
Hey Jack, going back to Starlight Racing, you have an exciting project going on, I think is worth talking about. I see now that you're going to open up a stable in Australia, and that's really kind of outside the box thinking. Tell us more about that. And are you mainly seeking American clients for that, or will they be Australian partners?
So we did it, our first year was last year, actually. My daughter and I went down there, Eleanor, actually exactly a year ago, in 2019 or 2020, whenever this 2020 is hard to get behind us. But and we participated. We bought about 10% of the stock in the partnership that Henry Field and Newgate put together, and Tom Ryan's involved with it also. So a few of our partners decided they want to, you know, test the waters down there, and actually got off to a pretty good start. We've had three winners. This horse named Captivance possibly could be running, pointing for the Golden Slipper. So it's another one of these partnerships that you've got somebody like Henry and Tom and Bob, Gavin Murphy. So that's how we got started. As we speak, we're buying the second crop that we're involved with. I guess we bought, Benny, how many have we bought?
Six yesterday,
something like that. So it's just going to be a fun thing, hopefully, and hopefully we can have some success. I think there's a lot of economic benefits, if there's such a thing, in horse racing in Australia versus up here. But as far as the strength of the dollar and overhead and training expenses, and actually the purses down there are unbelievable. So hopefully we'll have some fun success.
And Jack, we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you about a shout out and what it was like to have her, you know, winning 7 grade ones over 12 wins, 2-time horse of the year, and ultimately, you know, inducted into the Hall of Fame and sold for $9 million at auction as a broodmare prospect. What was it like? Take us back to that ride of owning her and campaigning a filly of that magnitude.
Jonathan, thanks for bringing her up. Everybody seems to have forgotten the oldies but goodies. But, you know, actually, talking about this jouster, I don't know if you guys have looked at her pedigree, but, you know, Storm Flag Flying is down there, I think, the second dam. And
yep.
Shotto ran against her once or twice, I think. And but that was just an unbelievable experience. Actually, it was the first partnership that I'd put together. My wife and I were just doing it on our own. And we, the first partnership we formed was with a Shadow and Purge and one other horse that couldn't run. So that was a pretty good start. But aside from all that stuff, she was such a classy filly mare. What's amazing about her was her soundness. Once we sent her to Todd as a 2-year-old, she never came back. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And for the families and of the partners and my family, it's just unbelievable. And then the Hall of Fame thing, I don't know how we pulled that one off.
But well, she certainly earned it. I mean, she was just, you know, quite a race filly. And Jack, I know you'll appreciate this because we've been in the business almost the same amount of time. But I've noticed that a lot of the fillies we owned and ran against are starting to go from being the first dam to the second dam to the third dam. That we're not getting any older, but man, those pedigrees are getting longer.
It trust me, I've noticed that. you know, unfortunately, maybe she has something this time, but just like a lot of these race mares that are so good on the track have trouble, you know, throwing good runners from there, but they keep you know, breeding her to good stallions, so hopefully we'll see something on the racetrack.
Before we let you go, I wanted to just get your quick take on the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act. Obviously, a big deal that it got passed. Didn't seem likely a year ago, but now it's law. Obviously, there's still a lot of details still to be worked out, so I don't expect you to have a strong opinion about it, but just some brief thoughts about what that could mean for racing going forward.
Well, I think any of us would be crazy to say that unification of the industries is not a good thing. It is. It's, you know, hopefully it can be pulled off. I guess this would be the best way to go about it. You know, there's some things that I'm not crazy about that's included in the thing, but that's really beside the point. I think the point is that they've got the thing passed. They've got some key people that seem like it's going to be put together properly. And then the funding thing, I think that Jim mentioned the other day, is not going to be paid by the gamblers. Unfortunately, guess who that leaves? the owners and the tracks, I guess. But, you know, I don't think we can be critical of the thing. If we want to throw in this LASIK thing, you know, which for a long time, I think sort of delayed it. I get to joke on no race day medication, but there are also some very good benefits to the horses that have a bleeding problem. So hopefully something can be found there.
Right. Yeah, I think there's definitely some kind of middle ground there. Thank you so much for joining us, Jack. We really appreciate it talking to you, and best of luck the rest of the year with Charlatan and all the other big horses you guys have.
Okay, thanks, Joe. Talk to you all later.
Thanks, Jack.
Well, the Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by the Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Jack Wolf will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from the Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust the Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over four decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit the Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Remember, the Keeneland January sale is going on today and then the closer tomorrow. So get involved now or forever hold your peace. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group Guest of the Week, Jack Wolf, our producer, Patty Wolf, our editors, Danny Cyper, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Anthony LaRocca. Thank you so much for watching. Please wear a mask. We'll see you next week.